Episode number 212 with Veronica Brill. Welcome to the Heads Up Poker Podcast. This is Steve Barton.
Steve, do you mind if I gotta whisper one thing? My son's in the room, next room over, and I'm kind of stoned right now, still from last night. So I think there's a chance I could be, comedically speaking, very on today, very funny. You know what I'm saying? I sense it.
Why am I not surprised?
Anyways, nice. I didn't get back from the casino until almost 6 a.m.
Oh, okay.
I really didn't need anything to help me sleep, but it's kind of, you know, yeah, something I do here because I do need help with my sleep. But then it was stupid because I had to set the alarm for three hours later. So anyways, I'm just happy to be here, Steve.
Right on.
I kind of like the whisper, you know, kind of radio voice. Late night. If I ever have a late night, overnight radio show doing love songs from the 70s, yeah, it'll be some sort of loving whisper or something. I don't know.
It's good to have you back, Mikey.
Hello, Steve.
Few weeks, but it feels like years.
When have we spoke? When was the last time we actually spoke on this program? I mean, obviously, I saw you in Vegas.
Let's see. Well, I did. Last week was Carlos, so it was the time before that. It may have been 3 weeks or so, at least. I don't know.
I don't know if I have even the energy, Steve, to bitch about bad beats in Vegas. I'm kind of over it.
Well, I kind of feel like we're hiding our lead here. Veronica's going to be our guest today. She has a show, Veronica and Friends. I watched it last night. It's kind of a Live at the Bike-esque show, so it was neat. She's up in Sacramento. She recently just got 13th out of almost 1,000 people in the ladies event. I'm excited. I think she's going to be an interesting.
She seems very interesting.
She does. Yeah.
If this interview sucks, Steve, it's all on us.
Yeah.
Because she should have some interesting things to talk about.
Yes. Yes. I'm excited. So how have you been? How's the weight loss challenge going?
Steve, I was talking about Vegas. Can you? I had a good story to tell.
Am I tangenting off too much here? Okay,
yeah,
go on.
Yeah, man. just let me spit my jazz and just stay out of the way, for God's sakes. No, not really. I was actually going to compliment or say I liked the last Carlos episode, and he kind of discussed some of the things I wanted to discuss at a certain level. Mm-hmm. Not that I want to see my friends fail, but he kind of had the same miserable ass experience in Vegas that I did.
Yeah.
And just was kind of broken and just talking about, like, for him, he'd talk about the win. He used to talk about the win tournaments as being value in these small, and now he's even over those now.
Huh.
So,
yeah.
I think, Steve, with your positivity, maybe you missed some of that. Like, you thought Carlos was joking, but I think he had like a major revelation about Vegas and poker tournaments. So I would have actually liked to have been part of that conversation. But I just wanted to make my Vegas synopsis, I guess, whatever.
There is.
I'm just looking for
payout structures, man. It's so flat, you know?
Well, that's the thing. It's not even. I mean, there's a lot of people in Vegas, so you could probably look, who had 10 caches this summer who like lost money.
Yeah.
Easily. Yeah. You have to go deep in these things, and it's just, you would have to play such a large volume of them to really get that big score to make it all profitable, I think. And maybe, you know, maybe I'm just not good enough at poker to make that happen anyways. I don't know anymore. So, we can go to the prep. But returning really withered financially, so to speak, in California here. So I got to roll up my sleeves and go to work.
Yeah, yeah.
I've played 100 hours since in the 10 days I've been back from Maine.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, this is just what my reality is right now. I gotta, even if like one game breaks, I'm gonna have to go play the 2-3, and you know, make some money. For the first time, my debts are bigger than my cash at hand. I never thought I'd get to this point. I said I'd get a job beforehand, but that ain't gonna happen. Keep battling.
Yeah, How's the cash games going?
I've probed out. I found the person who's gonna lend me money if I dip a little more.
Okay.
So yeah, I took out a list of people and all the people who would lend me money.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve, you were the first one at the top of your list, but I'm like, oh God, geez, I've been mocking the goddamn guy for 5 years now. Like, a lot of people think that this might be a shtick that I talk like I'm a loser, but you know what I mean? That could really change the podcast too, you know?
I was like, I hope I'm not on that list. And then you tell me I'm number one. I'm like, shit.
No, don't worry. But it was, yeah, it would change the temper of this. If I had missed a payment, let's say, and we got here, I'm in a good mood to talk about poker. And you're like, listen up, motherfucker. You're going to see the dark side right now. Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah, what's going on? The weight loss. I got to either get some money, probably a bet wager again. I was kind of incentivized also for just losing, you know, I live a block from the beach. Hey, let's get cut up here and, you know, go down and talk to chicks at the beach. But I'm just, since I've made my commitment to never speaking to a woman again, unless it's on a podcast.
Mm-hmm. So today will not be a violation of that oath.
No. Yeah, I went shopping to get all the stuff and I've been eating good at home, but, yeah, it's funny. Last night I lost a big pot and immediately just called the waitress over and got myself a turkey club.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually is a horrible meal. Turkey club and French fries. That's a horrible meal for my diet.
That's not just
calories, but I'm trying to do plan only.
Well, the bread is really bad. The French fries are bad.
Yeah, but like for like I said, I'm trying to get away from bacon and meat and everything like that. So the whole thing was pretty terrible. I don't know, Steve, what else, what's going on with you now?
You know, I was talking to my friend about this. We went fishing a few days ago, deep sea fishing, and he kind of had a wake up call and he's like, you know, I got to lose some weight, and we're talking about it. And I have cheat days, you know, but when I'm not on a cheat day, what I eat is so extremely healthy that I can have one, sometimes two cheat days a week. You know, so for like breakfast, it's just like eggs and spinach. And then like for lunch, it's just a heaping pile of vegetables and then a little bit of meat on top, and same for dinner. And I do that for days at a time. And then one day I just wake up and I have my egg and spinach breakfast and I have whatever the hell I want. I mean, I'll eat a whole pizza by myself. I'll drink as much beer as I want. But then the very next day I'm right back on it, you know? So everyone's going to cheat. I mean, you're only human, you know? So don't beat yourself up about the turkey sandwich. You know, when you have it, enjoy it, but then get right back on the program and you'll still lose weight.
Well, for me, yeah, like I said, I'd like to for health reasons, make a permanent change to the plant only. Yeah. But also, Steve, my sort of personality type, you know, the alcoholic, you can drink zero, the disciplined one, but they can't drink three beers a day.
Yeah.
They're going to drink towards
12. Yeah.
I remember one artist, he's talking about, he's kind of the same thing. He's like, I can drink three packs of cigarettes a day or zero, you know, anything in between. Three packs
or zero. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Anything in between is impossible. So it's kind of like when I start doing cheat day, that's when I did, when I got down 199 pounds, I said, I'm going to give myself 2 days just to go hog wild and enjoy this,
mm-hmm.
enjoy the food. And then I'm going to turn around and go back. And yeah.
Oh, and then you just never went back. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I don't know. That's the way I run it, you know, because I mean, I feel like if 85% of what you eat is healthy and the other 15% is junk, to go from 85% to 100% just never cheating, like that is multiple times more difficult, not just 15% more difficult, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah.
What else is going on? Got any chicks in your life, Steve?
Dating. That's about it. Nothing. Nothing too serious. You? Doesn't sound like it.
Steve, was that necessary?
That was an unnecessary shot across the bow. I'm sorry.
There was actually a little. You know, it was like a little futuristic what computers can do, or you know, like a little mechanical arm just jumped out from my screen and tried to shiv me in the gut there, and I barely avoided it. your piercing words.
Oh, dude.
No, that's okay.
Let's see. What else about? I won a little tournament yesterday.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, 1100 profit. That was good. Only 26 runners, but it was quick and just the. I really should be playing every $100 and above tournament over there. I played. They had one. They got one every month. It's like $235 buy-in. And they've got another one coming up. That's a, now see the thing about these tournaments is they're all turbos. They got the same structure. Basically it's 18 minute levels. You get a break every three levels for 10 minutes. And the structure goes up quick. I mean, most of these start with 1,000 or 10,000 in chips. Blind levels are 100, 200. So you're immediately starting with, 50 bigs there. So it's, and they go up from there to 100, 200, 2, 4, 3, 6, 4, 8. I think they skip the 1,000 level, and then they go like to right to 1,200. But they're having a 575 tournament here. You start with 15K in chips. Then if you add another 10 bucks, you get another 2K. And then if you bring in two, they're having a canned food drive. If you bring in like two cans of beans or something, then you get another 1K in chips. So you can start this with 18K at 585. 85 is the rake. And but it's the same 18 minute levels. They're not advertising it. They're putting it on an odd hour,
right?
I talked to the tournament director and he said they're afraid because the Commerce puts these on and they get like 900 people, and he's all, we're just a little card room, we can't, you know, it's about a third the size of Ocean's 11.
Yeah, Ocean's 11 is funny, is the same thing. They cap the number of entries for their tournaments.
That's what they're doing with this. They're
so, which is kind of, seems counterintuitive, but they really have no choice.
Yeah, they just
don't. You have the regulars with the cash game tables. You can't just take those out for a tournament sake, obviously.
Yeah.
Got to keep your regulars happy. It is interesting. You know, we discussed quickly, I'm not going to, the Andrew Pieper told you what his Vegas hourly is for these little tournaments.
Yeah.
And I mean, we've already got that sense. I mean, he's like he's an equity magnet. He looks at every single thing you get, from every dollar you can get through, promotions or just working at playing at certain hours here.
Yep.
Maybe you can get those kind of results. I still think, obviously, the only way you could make a living off playing those tournaments would be if you have no kid and are living in a car, probably.
Yeah.
I don't mean that even as like a mocking, of course. We are quite fond of the vehicle dwellers.
Yes.
We do not discriminate. Here. But and of course in Vegas they probably have smaller rake on those daily tournaments maybe than elsewhere, just because of competition purposes. They have to lower the rake a little bit. I don't know, it could be wrong. What the daily rake is for most of those tournaments, but I'm sure Andrew knows, obviously.
Yeah.
Did we discuss this? It's interesting. You won. I'm assuming you just didn't chop. You just played to the end, or did you?
No, I played to the end. They wanted to chop at four-handed top three paid. They wanted to get money back. I said no, and then they wanted to. Well, actually, they wanted to chop at the final table. I said no, and then they asked again a few players later, and I said, I just want to play like that. I pointed at the prize pool, and then when it got down to four and the top three paid, I was third in chips and there was a guy fourth, and they offered to pay fourth place. And I thought, I have him covered now. I'm good. The next hand, I took him out. It was blind on blind. I had king two, he had queen 10, and then I rivered some weird straight. And
the next time somebody asks you about chopping, just say, bitch, I own three houses and a plane, for God's sakes. I think maybe I brought this up on a recent podcast, but I was reading something that Jonathan Little said. I know someone you have a lot of respect for.
Yeah.
He was saying at your local casino, you should never chop because you need practice in these shorthanded situations and practice in actually winning a tournament for when you take a shot at a different tournament.
Yeah.
So
tens of thousands on the line. You want to have a memory of.
Yeah. When you get as many, you win your local, if you get a couple first place there, you want to go take a shot at a bigger one, a little $500 tournament at a different casino with the, now I kind of disagree with them because it's totally like these daily, like the average stack for that final table was probably like 15 bigs when you got done a four-handed or something, right? Or is that
about right? It was probably deep to 12 or 13. It was,
okay. So
yeah,
that's,
but, not yeah, really, I get your point. Yeah. You're it's kind of a crapshoot.
If you ever make the final table of a $500 at the Venetian, mm-hmm. It's going to be 50 big blinds effective probably and against very good players. So, yeah.
My edge here in these tournaments is knowing my calling ranges and knowing my shoving ranges. Like, that's the biggest edge I have, because most of the tournament you're playing, you know, 20 big blinds or less, and players are just, their calling and shoving ranges are just so far off. So that's where my real edge comes in. And then another part too,
I think your real edge, Steve, frankly, is they get so bored by hearing stories of the firehouse. They just want to get their chips and get the fuck out of there.
They finally say F it. They just go for it. It's like when they were asking me, when we got to three handed, they still wanted to do a chip chop. And I had like 40% of the chips in play and I wasn't interested. And I was like, I said, no, I want to play like that. And you could see the other two guys at the table. They had both like accepted third or second. You know what I mean? Like, it was like a psychological thing. By not even entertaining a chop, they had just accepted that they weren't going to win. And you could see it when they play. And half an hour later, that's what happened. You're giving yourself an edge, you know, I think.
Yeah, you would. I mean, honestly, you would. I would be trying to, in any sort of like 1K, probably with deep down with money. Well, you know, I'm too much of a trophy whore. I would want a trophy, but I would definitely be in a situation often, well, it's because of my current economic situation, but any time, because I'm a pro, where I might be willing to give up a little equity just to get that chop, just to guarantee some more money. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's not the way to go about it. You should fight for every, well, I already told the story of the tournament. I wanted Oceans, whatever, I guess it's 2 years ago now, where I had the big chip lead. First place was 15,000 on the final table. I was going to get 10.
Yeah.
Which was pretty good. I think, because like not 10th place was probably like, you know, $1,100 just to, okay, a slight chance I run bad. I had the big, huge chip lead and I had like 35 bigs kind of thing.
Yeah.
So a lot of variant, but I could have easily fought for, Jason was at this final table. And I think I said I could have, should have been fighting for money because they all were desperate to chop. Just like, give me each $100. They would have been done.
Yeah.
But I'm such a wuss. It was like, I told you there's
one. You could have got another $900 right there. Yeah. I see what you mean.
Yeah. And some guy took out a photograph. He's like, man, please, for my, he took out a picture of his wife's sonogram. He was having a kid soon.
Baby.
And I knew I made up just by making a deal. I knew I'd given money away because they were also, thank you so very much, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just like I handed out little Christmas gifts there. So,
yeah.
Speaking to your point, either you're not going to play it out, it should be because maybe you're getting more money than you should. That would be.
I think so. Like that little Rio daily that I had 10% into the chips in play and they were offering me 20% of the money. I think Andrew Pieper would just scream if I didn't take that deal, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. And they were happy to do it. So that was cool. But for even money at the final three there, no, I think I had a big edge. But let's see.
Do you know, Steve, your ex-wife follows me on Instagram?
That's a little creepy.
I don't think, well, no, she was from what, back when you were married. It's not like she recently jumped on. And I actually can't look at her pics unless I follow her, which I have not done.
Okay. That's interesting. I wonder, oh, so she followed you from years ago when we were married.
Yeah, I think that's just what it was.
Okay.
She was just in case I took some pictures of you bare ass in a Vegas hotel room.
She could use them against me.
I actually did take those pictures. I just didn't post them to Instagram.
Yeah. they're still on your phone, just waiting to be released.
No, but I was thinking it'd be funny if I took some pictures of me and you on Instagram and it was just you, you know, staring straight ahead at the camera with like a knife in your hand, a little t-shirt. I'm coming for you, bitch. Like, technically, you have broken no laws there. You know what I'm saying? That could just be.
But I'm about to break a dozen of them, right?
Well, it could be just you and I joking around, doing some little one act plays in my house. You know, that kind of stuff, Steve. I don't know. You're in such a good mood, Steve. Why would I bring up the ex? About the only thing that can ever kill you or put you in a sour mood.
Oh, she's a gem. That's for sure. I've been running a lot. I'm up to 7.3 miles is my furthest so far.
Wow. One time. When's the half marathon coming, or did you already do that? I forget.
Well, I'm signed up for a full marathon. That's not until March of next year. But I've been talking with some runners, and three people so far have advised me to sign up for a half marathon before my marathon. They're like, you need something like a goal to focus on in between now and then, because it's so far away. You need, like something else in between there, and that'll prep you for the marathon. I'm like, that's probably a really good point. So I'm going to sign up for one locally here. It's in December. And then that'll kind of give me that's 13.1. So I'm more than halfway there already. And that's not until, what is that, 4 or 5 months away?
Is that the whole idea of the runner's high? Is that a real thing?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. You kind of get in this zone. Like the first mile or so is probably like the most awkward. And then once you get into your pace, you just kind of feel like this machine that's just chugging along, and you're not breathing hard. Like what I'm doing is I'm running very slow. I'm running at a pace to where I could have a conversation with someone and never be out of breath.
Okay.
And you're just running really slow, and every step your body loosens up a little bit more and becomes a little bit more efficient and a little bit more efficient. And so maybe your first mile time is like, for me, it would be maybe 14 minutes. And then my second mile time is 13:30. And then my third mile time is 13 minutes. And like, so as you go and go, you're becoming more efficient and faster and faster. And then you kind of get to a place where you're getting diminished returns, you know, instead of, you know, you were at 12 and a half minutes per mile, and now you're at 12:45. That's the point where you kind of have to push yourself through the distance of the run. And then you stop and you rest. And then you have these little recovery runs, and then you have these high intensity days where you're just for only 20 or 30 minutes, but you're running up a hill as fast as you can and then walking down it, and then running up a hill as fast as you can and then walking down it. And it's fun. It's fun. I like it. I especially like the long, slow runs when you get in the groove and you're just breathing correctly and everything's clicking. It's fun to go discover new areas and run up in the hills, and I dig it. Yeah. You lose a lot of weight too, man. I've lost, I was at probably 167, 165 regularly, and now I'm bouncing between 158 and 160.
How tall are you? That's pretty lean for sure.
5'10".
That sounds good. That's your high school playing weight, Steve.
It pretty much is, yeah.
I don't know what your high school, you were wrestling team in high school, right?
I did wrestling, and then I quit, and then I did football for a week. I went through Hell Week, and then I quit that. But I prefer to think of my glory days as post-high school when I was on the hand crew. And then I was 155. I was lean and just super strong. Right. I don't feel quite as strong now, but I'm about that same weight.
I got to see your – just occurred to me. Next time you come down here, if you come down, can you bring your high school yearbook? Because there's probably a smiling pic of you on like every page.
You know?
Where are you?
That would be interesting.
You probably just accidentally walked into like 20 pictures where you're just smiling in the background and, you know.
There is a bit of that. Yeah. My senior year of high school, I was voted friendliest.
Of course. Yes.
Probably very fitting. And I was on the high school yearbook club or whatever. So one class every day for the whole year was us designing and taking pictures and you know, making the yearbook. And so, yeah, there's probably an excessive amount of Barton in there.
Right. Of course, man. I can see you.
Yeah.
for the good of the school.
For yes. Yeah. Yeah. Not no selfish interest whatsoever for the good of the school.
Quickly, that's right. I did want to ask about the earthquake we had a few weeks ago. Pretty epic one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I forget. Were you in Vegas at the time or?
No, I was back working. I was at the fire station, and we kind of got to take all these protocols once an earthquake happens. We got to pull all the rigs out of the apparatus bay in case another one hits and the station collapses. At least we still have a fire engine. And then we got to do circles in our first in districts, checking for any damage, of which there was none because we're located pretty far from where the epicenter was. Yeah, I was working. I felt the second one. It was interesting. It was kind of about 40 seconds long and long enough to make you feel like you're a little bit nauseated, like you're on a ship and you feel like you need to throw up. Yeah, but I never felt in any danger. How were you down there? Were you close?
The closest thing you feared is Steve. You know, I was going to say you almost crashed your plane and you just laughed it through. So here, I'm sure, like, you're just like the earth could split open. You're like, geez, I might not be able to go for my run later on. That could be the height of your
excitement.
Yes, I was in Maine when the earthquake happened.
Oh, okay, all right.
We never know. I mean, of course, a lot of them are alarmist, I guess, or want to give the, you know, but a lot of these students of Teutonics, or however you would put the, however you would express the people who know most about earthquakes, say there's just going to be a massive one in Southern California at some point. But I guess the very dead center of that is what, a little north of LA? So maybe maybe you're enough north of LA and I'm enough south of LA that we're not quite in the imminent
zone.
Danger spot.
I don't know. I mean,
that, I don't know, obviously, but I'm just.
I watched a program on earthquakes not too long ago. It was one of those Discovery Channel ones, and they said that there's a 99% chance that there'll be a 8.0 or greater magnitude earthquake in Southern California in the next 30 years. And they said that statistic just repeats itself every year. And so I just look at it like it's just a roll of the dice living in this area. You know, you can either choose to live in tsunami zone or you can choose to live in the,
right.
I don't know, earthquake zone. And it, you're either going to, that's it. And it's going to happen somewhere in Southern California. Pick it San Diego, pick it LA, or pick it Merced
right.
County. I don't know.
I don't think you can't panic over it, but, yeah. Yeah, there's actually a fascinating article in Newsweek. I think there's talking about the biggest, most dangerous fault line is not the San Andreas down here.
Really?
The biggest chance of just like an epic destructive earthquake is in the Pacific Northwest. I forget it's. And she went into great detail with this. Basically, it would be like the tsunami in Japan.
Okay.
And they went through and discussed it, like all the different things that are going to happen. And it's... pretty much if you saw in the video, Japan, very similar. There's going to be just these 30-foot waves just crashing and just going straight through for miles and miles.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess they talked to really breaking down the topography of that whole area. And, it'll take years to recover, 30,000 dead, da, 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 you know, but it's like they have whole areas out there,
mm-hmm.
which they have, they've introduced zoning and laws that you can't build new housing. And so, I mean, they've done a couple preparation things, like try to not have people living in the most dangerous parts. But again, it might be all for nothing.
Yeah. We'll see. We'll see. Let's take a quick break and then we'll bring in Veronica. I want to take a sec and thank our sponsors. One of which, Elliot Rowe, you know who I'm talking about. Listen to an MP3, a meditation tape, a hypnosis tape, just before you play. It'll put you in the right mindset. You can focus on the game. Focus on poker. It's exactly what I did just before yesterday when I won that tournament at my local casino. I listened to a live MTT MP3 by Elliot Rowe. And you know what? For those 3.5 hours from 26 players down to one, all I was thinking about was the game. And I don't know if I would have won the tournament without listening to Elliot first, but I know I won it listening to him. So get your free one. You can get a free 7-minute tilt buster by clicking on the link in the show notes. And when you get one of his MP3s, use the code HUPOKER and score yourself a discount. Also want to thank Alexander Fitzgerald for sponsoring the show. You guys can get a free hour-long instructional video. Links are in the show notes or go to headsuppoker.poker. And if you decide to purchase his full program, which I recommend you do, it was awesome for me, especially just before the WSOP. It's about 4 hours long. He's got all the charts and everything in there on how to master tournament poker in one class. If you do what he suggests in that program, you will be in the top 5%. Guaranteed. Use the code HUPOKER, score yourself 75% off of Alex's program, Master Tournament Poker in One Class. Okay, without further ado, Veronica Brill. Veronica Brill, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes.
I've learned a lot about earthquakes so far.
Yeah, you came in just at the end of that.
I'm like, am I on the right podcast?
This is a poker podcast, right? Well, I'm Steve. This is my buddy, my partner,
Hello. Brian,
Mike.
Hi, Mike. Hi, Steve.
You got a quick introduction to the difference between me and Steve. We're just talking about earthquakes, and Steve, you can just shrugging. Well, yeah, it might come. And I'm like, grab the women and kids and move to Iowa.
I mean, it's inevitable, and in 30 million years, Andromeda will crash into our Milky Way, and, you know, shit happens.
True.
That's interesting. Quickly, Steve, before we could look at Veronica's Twitter, she does describe herself, among other things, as a nihilist.
Nihilist? Yeah. What is
a nihilist? Yes. I don't really think anything long-term matters. I think short term, my life matters. I think I make decisions that are I try to make decisions that are best for the people around me and be cognitive of that. But I think long term, nothing matters because the universe is expanding. All energy will dissipate. We will not be a thing. You know, it's just.
I couldn't agree more. That's interesting. I didn't know what that word meant. That's nihilist.
Nihilism is basically, yeah, not. It's a belief that, like, the easiest way, you can break down nihilism, you can read books about nihilism, but it's just basically nothing really matters.
Yeah, we're just such a small speck in the giant wheel that it doesn't,
right?
In the long run, it really doesn't.
You're a half a speck, Steve. Stop giving yourself too much credit.
How about three quarters? Can we get at least three quarters of a speck?
And people think, you know, it's so sad to hear you talk like that. How can you say that? And I'm like, well, actually, you know, it gives me a lot of meaning because it makes me appreciate every day. Like, I don't think I'm going to, you know, a place that's going to have harps 24/7.
Yeah.
I just know what I have now, I have to make the best of.
Yeah. So. I feel the same way. I feel like a lot of people are living their life right now in hopes of having a better one when they're gone.
Yeah. It's just weird. I mean, there's no evidence of that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm open to it.
I would love it to be true.
I don't want to go where there's harps. I definitely want to go where there's some degenerate gambling. So.
Yes, yeah. Horse betting would be nice. Poker would be amazing.
If there are two biblical options, I would prefer to go to the one that most people are at and we're going to be gambling.
Yes, yeah. Wagering large sums of money over small edges for a long time.
Yeah,
I like it. Well, I got to see your show last night. So for the listeners, describe what your third Saturday of every month looks like, because I got a feeling it's probably not like most of ours.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to see what chaos and poker combined becomes, although I will say that I did my best to make last night's game a smaller game.
Okay.
Because I have been, my game is known for, you know, being, it's deceptive. It's sold as a 1-3, but because of this way Stone structures their games, there's a cap on the buy-in, but the cap is only the table max. And typically 90% of the time there will be an all-in within the first 1 to 2 hands. Someone will double up, and the cap on a 1-3 at Stones when the game starts is 500. So someone will double up to 1,000.
Then everyone reloads.
Everyone
to 1,000?
Adds on.
Okay.
And usually within 20 to 30 minutes, everyone has 2,000 in front of them. And my friends who I typically invite to the game that I did not invite yesterday because I wanted it to be a normal game will bring 20,000 to the game. I'm not even kidding.
I was just going to say that game has to be a pro magnet on a certain level.
In some ways, I will allow a couple of pros to play, but I typically just bring in business owners and people who would like to play big but don't want to play you know, at a regular game where pros have the option to sit down and just, you know, put their headphones on and vacuum up the money.
Yeah,
the whole point of the game is for people to enjoy themselves. The pros that I do invite are social, and we all, you know, we all have wine, we all order lots of food. We typically will grab dinner before the game starts, so all of us kind of hang out. It's more of like a social event.
Yeah.
Alicia, my best girlfriend in the game, who's one of my closest friends, you know, last month made $19,000 in a 1-3 game.
Wow.
So, I mean,
is this just the Veronica home game where it's you can match the stack, or is that the normal game at Stones?
It's the normal game at Stones.
Wow.
That's
pretty nice. Have you guys been out to Stones?
I have not.
No, I have. It's just northeast of Sacramento, right?
Right. It's probably like a block or two from Sacramento. I'm surprised they don't just say Sacramento, but it's officially in Citrus Heights proper. But yeah. It's got to be one of the best card rooms I've ever played in. And I'm not actually employed for Stones. I get a hosting fee, but I have, you know, nothing to promote for Stones. It doesn't mean anything to me to say anything about them, but I'm telling you, the card room is very posh and nice. And they have a 24-hour really nice restaurant attached. Well, it's in the building. And so you get 24 hours of food, really good service. I just haven't seen anything like that anywhere else. And then the games, besides the 1-2, are all stacked match. And there's, as they say in Northern California, hella action.
I was sold just on the big bull's head on the wall. I love the aesthetic of the place.
Yeah. So they've got like, I was raised in Canada, so I'm not great with my US history. We just, Canadians hate Americans in general. And we just,
right.
Really? I've never noticed.
Besides, we burned down the White House and everyone talks about that. But I guess like Buffalo Bill and all these like Wild West characters, they're all painted. They're beautiful, large paintings, and they're all over the place. And it's just got a really cool atmosphere.
We got it. Steve, do you need a minute to decompress? Because he despises Canadians. He might have to catch his breath. This Canadian-American thing, Steve, you know, we're always talking about the problems at the border. This people should pay attention to that, because that this fucking powder keg's ready to blow. Let me
yeah.
let you know.
Yeah, obviously.
They're mad, and they're going to do something about it.
Yeah, they've got their health care. Everyone's mad, and they're paying 60% taxes. But it's fine, you know. You guys can want that.
Can we actually go back a little bit? I looked up, of course, Googled you and looked at everything I could find. I didn't really see.
God.
Maybe it's because I really follow you closely on Twitter, and you're very talented with that. That I'm just assuming you're this poker star, and I just Google your name, and there'd be like a million interviews telling you about. But I haven't seen anything about, like, you know, how you got to America and how you got into poker. Can we maybe do a little of that? okay, yeah, I'm sorry.
No, you're fine.
You're kidnapped. I understand now.
I've been playing poker probably since I was like in my early 20s. And someone tweeted something quite funny the other day, and it was like Mario Brothers and like poker in the 2000s. And then it was like a Mario, like, you know, the Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
And then like it's this like super advanced version that's impossible to get through, and they were saying like poker now, and that's what poker was when I did nursing school. I did an undergrad in nursing in Canada, and I think I made more money while I was working as a nurse's aide to pay for school. I think I made more money in poker than I did as a nurse's aide or anything. And even when I became a nurse, I continued playing poker, and it was so much easier back then. I was actually very lucky in some sense, because I was living quite north in Canada by a big oil rig. It was like 2 hours north of my city.
Those guys make good money.
Really good money. And they don't need an education. A lot of guys were like 10th grade dropouts. And they were finding $250,000 a year jobs in the oil rigs and the oil, whatever it is, what is it called when they remove the oil from the sand?
Oh,
I used to paint
a bunch of equipment on oil platforms, and like they talk about this all the time, and now I can't recall it.
So they're removing the oil from the sand up there.
They remove it from the sand and they pull it. Yes. Okay.
Yeah, and so a lot of these guys on weekends would drive down to Edmonton and set their money on fire. And I would literally just play ABC. If I had it, I'd put money in. If I didn't, I'd fold. There was just a copious amount of drinking, and I was making money, and I thought I was amazing at poker. I was terrible.
I'm so good at this game.
I still am. Poker is like impossible. It's so abstract. There's just so many layers to thinking about every single hand. I find data science so much easier. But anyway, yeah, so I was living in Canada and
playing. So you're a winning player from the beginning, it sounds like, which is really rare. I mean, did you have...
I think anybody who was sober and knew which hands won was a winning player.
Okay. I'm sorry, I cut you off. What were you going to say next?
No. And then I moved to the States for a relationship, and that didn't work out. But I ended up staying. I work in tech now, and long story short, poker's gotten harder. I moved to Sacramento, and the guy who started Stones Live, I did commentary for Stones Live for years, and I still do once in a while. I'm actually doing commentary with Dave Tuckman October 4th at Stones.
Cool.
But I started doing commentary. I went up to the guy who was starting Stones Live, and I was like, look, I used to host pageants. I used to like have a radio show. I was a DJ. Like I can do some color commentary for you.
Yeah, get me in front of a microphone.
Put me in the booth with. And he said, okay. He didn't really have anyone. And my friend Jake got put in the booth with me, and he's a fairly competent poker player, and he tolerates me a little bit. And we did like 3 years of being like the main commentary duo for Stones. So.
Huh. That's cool. That's cool. And now most of the time, like last night, you're playing. You're not up in the booth.
Well, yeah, I moved to San Jose about a year ago for a job. Okay. And the traffic, if it wasn't for the traffic, I'd be in Sacramento every weekend. It's just so bad.
How long does it take you to get from San Jose up to Stones? Like 2 hours?
So if there's no traffic, like last night I drove back home. If there's no traffic, it's like an hour and a half, hour and 40 minutes.
Okay.
I also drive an S5, so I drive really fast.
But, speed demon.
Yeah. But I would say like when there's traffic, it can be like it took me 6 hours. It makes me insane. I think this is how people in the Bay Area go insane.
Yeah.
The traffic.
Yeah.
So I actually don't think I'm going to continue with Veronica and Friends too much longer, but I'll probably just come in once every couple months to do commentary or something.
Fair enough. Cool. So you said you're
You jumped before over. What did you say before? You had a radio show and you were doing interviews for what? I'm just saying.
No, when I was in my early 20s, I was a DJ and I had a radio show. There's no fame in anything I'm talking about. It's kind of how I approached the guy running Stones Live to see if I could do commentary.
Okay. Cool. You mentioned you're in software implementation and data science. What does that mean?
So I actually work for the county of San Jose. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful county, and I work for the hospital. And when I interviewed, I didn't think that I would like it as much as I do, but they're doing some really good stuff there. And they're in Silicon Valley, so they have to be competitive with, you know, Google and Microsoft. So I'm implementing new software in their acute rehabilitation facility. And it's just like a wonderful facility, wonderful physicians and nurses. And then there's really no one there that does clinical analytics. and I'm doing a master's in data science, which is basically predictive analytics. And I told my boss when I was interviewing that I wanted to do some of that in my job. She said, okay. And so I do like a lot of the physician dashboards that have to deal with operational data and clinical data. I'm not in the actual analytics team, but they do more like financial analytics and like trending, you know, 3 years of trending of something.
So is it like doctors say, okay, this month we had 40 patients that had diabetes. These are the treatments that we gave them. And then a month later, we'll see what the results are. You run through that data and figure out which works best and then put that into an operation, or am I way off?
No, that could be a part of it. That kind of happens already. Like the system has some good analytics tools where that kind of stuff, I think they like to, I mean, there's two different ways. You can do like a per patient report or per groups of patients. You want to look at your patient, how they're trending with their treatments. But typically like with those kinds of things, they're using medications, unless they're doing a study, they're using medications that already have clinical results. Otherwise they wouldn't be approved.
Okay.
So typically like, I would say in the simplest thing, the doctors, the dashboard I just made for our physicians has the rehab impairment codes, because they're not a regular diagnosis. They use different coding for rehab. So I had to create some sort of data anchor that attached itself to where they're placing that, because they were writing it down, but it wasn't going anywhere. And okay. So I anchored the data and then I put it into a report, and they wanted a pie chart. I hate pie charts. So I gave them a pie chart.
You like stacks of chips a lot better, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, pie charts are just, I was just like, really? You want a pie chart? All right, I'll give you a pie chart. I don't love it. Like you can hover over it.
These millennials, Steve, look back at our old ways with pie charts. Nothing wrong with a pie chart.
What's wrong with Lincoln logs?
Shame. You bring shame to data science family.
Can I go a couple? You can cut me off here. My intense Google studies of you here. But I also saw your little YouTube page, which most of the videos seem older, but you were trying to bring knowledge about blenderized nutrition for children.
That's my registered nurse page. That's a different page. That has, yeah, there's no poker there. I have a poker YouTube channel.
Okay. I was going to drift from poker and ask what that is about. But yeah, let's get to poker, Steve, because we almost forgot to mention here, Veronica went very deep in a WSOP event.
Yes, 13.
So I'm sure many people who listen to this would like to know what that feels like. But, you know, Steve is still trying to figure out how to walk and chew gum. So he's
so an accomplishment.
He doesn't necessarily grasp the particulars of the excitement.
Me too. I'm still trying to walk and chew gum.
But you went 13th in the ladies event out of, I'm guessing there's more than 1,000 in there, or probably.
It was about 1,000. And like, it's cool to get that far, but I was still just choked up and heartbroken over a bad run of cards that had led me to be short stacked. And then I doubled up the girl who knocked me out. I believe, I'm just trying to think, she's a pretty famous poker player.
Lexi.
So I doubled up Lexi. She shoved with like a queen 10, and I had ace queen and a 10 team on the flop.
Eww.
And then I just remember I just couldn't gain any momentum. I still had raising chips. I think I had like 18 big blinds, and it was just, I couldn't make anything work. And then I got down to about 13 or 12 big blinds. And I remember shoving with, I can't remember what the bust out hand was. I think I had ace king and Lexi had king jack.
Yeah, I remember you had Ace King, and I don't remember what they had, but I was like, oh, that's...
Yeah, it was Lexi. There. Lexi knocked me out. So, yeah, she had a King Jack, and, like, I mean, she just, like, was coolering me all day. And she came to the table really short stacked. So, yeah. Good for her. I'm glad. I know she made final table. I think she got fifth place. But I was just really heartbroken because I was working really hard at avoiding landmines all day one and two. And day two, I was like one of the top chip leaders for most of day two, like towards the end. And then for the beginning of day three, I was chip leader or like second or third in chips on a regular basis. And it's just so frustrating that in poker, you can work so hard and grind for 3 days and then literally like two or three hands, a few cooler spots, you lose it all. And Vanessa too. Vanessa was playing really well, and she got out in 14th, so one before me.
Vanessa Selps? Vanessa Selps?
No.
Vanessa, she's a streamer. There's too many Vanessas.
We need to start numbering them.
she has a pink hair, and she's semi-famous.
Vanessa, I think, is it Cade, her last name?
Yeah, Vanessa Cade, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so actually Vanessa comes to Stones all the time.
She's
Vanessa does commentary at Stones. We've never done commentary together, but she has played on Veronica and Friends.
Okay.
Yeah. And she experienced true Veronica and Friends in its true form and got obliterated. And I don't mean drunk. I mean, like, she was like, what the fuck just happened?
Stacked.
Yeah. Quickly, Steve and I were talking about some of the crazy payout structures. And when I looked and saw for a 1K tournament that you could go through like 1,000 people and only get 7,000 is kind of like, this is pretty good evidence to me why they should only pay 10%. I don't know if you have any feelings on that.
I like that they, I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to make the top prize something really cool. You know, I understand that. I think like spreading out pay structures is also a great idea. I don't know if there's studies, but my, one of my best friends, Andrew Barber, he's finishing up his PhD in economics. I don't know if you guys know who he is. He has a 10K horse bracelet. He made a final table this year. Also, I like
to
call my best friend. Okay. He talks about, you know, like when you have jackpots and stuff, if you make the jackpot really heavy to one person, you end up like a lot of that money leaves poker. But if you like evenly distribute jackpots or winnings where they're smaller but viable, like 10,000 or 15,000, they end up like that money stays in poker.
Yeah, that's why they want an extra 5% to get paid. I mean, certainly a lot of the players like it too. They want to just see their name in Hended Mob and get that cash. I understand that. But it's also, you get a greater percentage of players, with money who can rebuy into a tournament so they can rake them again.
Right. Yeah. So, but I understand what they're doing. Like, the ladies event is a small buy-in and they want the first place prize to look good. Like, I don't know. I think it's fine to have it spread out a little more, but I see what they're doing. It's like, I think it's like a fine tooth comb argument. Like, we could really break it down, but
sure.
I don't know. I think it's fine either way.
Right. Well, I think for the full-time pros, it's definitely a big thumbs down in my opinion, but I'm sure there's some people will disagree.
Yeah, I agree.
I would have had a much better summer if it was a flatter, or if it was a, 10% instead of a 15, but bias there with you, Mikey. I was like, damn it.
Quickly, I was looking at some of the coverage for ladies event, and like when you had the big stack, I saw just a little write says, Veronica Brill, who's living up to her name with 900,000 in chips. But well, I was just curious, you have a cool nickname or reputation for stacking chips? I was wondering what living up to her name meant.
I don't even know what that means.
Okay.
I that's funny. I think like maybe my game comes across as crazy, and I've had a few wild nights in the booth with Jake and I early on. It was like we were recording in a basement and they would let us drink in the booth. And there were a few times where things got a little crazy in the booth. So I don't know. I don't know what this reputation is. I think like I'm an introverted extrovert.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I come across well socially, but really I just, I am like close to three people in my life.
That describes me pretty well too, actually. Quickly, was there like, as you were going deeper, were you having like friends and like family who were getting ready to fly in to see the final table? I mean, was there like,
yeah,
building excitement against your whole social circle as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, a lot of my close girlfriends were in the tournament, so they were, you know, waiting to see if I'd make the final table. Everyone thought for sure I would. I thought I would. Poker is such an amazing, like, culture, I guess you could say, where everyone was, like, ready to, you know, come rail the final table. And, there were a few people that were ready to come fly in. I was surprised.
That's cool. So. It's neat when you get that kind of support deep in a tournament, huh? It makes you feel...
Yeah, and I had people, you know, it's so funny because Twitter, I think Twitter's the only thing I'm really, you know, doing well at. And random people who follow me on Twitter were on the rail.
Yeah.
And they were messaging me. And I was like, whoa, this is so cool. I had no idea.
So you got a little fan club that you didn't even know of. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's cool. It's cool.
And yeah, you know, some guys were like, oh, are you single? I'm like, this is not a good time.
Yeah, let me focus.
I was going to say.
Mommy's playing.
I was going to ask you for actually with your fandom, you probably get a couple guys writing love poems to you and that kind of thing. I mean, is that like a ubiquitous issue or is that?
Yeah, I mean, poker is dominated by men. And when there's a woman playing, a lot of guys, especially professional poker players, I think like to have women that they're with understand what they do so that when they're out till 5 a.m. because a game is good, you know, you're not freaking out. I think, yeah, yes, I get hit on.
That's what you want. Right. Of course. Sure. Yeah. Naturally.
Canadian girl. That's that goes with the territory. I watched your hand with Bart Hansen, the bomb pot one.
Yes.
You know which one I'm talking about?
Yes.
Yes. That was really cool. Okay. So the bomb pot is everyone just throws in $40, right?
Yeah. So we had a progressive bomb pot in that game.
Okay.
I can't remember if we were, I don't know, were we at $40 then?
I wrote down bomb pot $40, so I think so.
Yeah, so we start the night with a $20 bomb pot, and we add $5 each time. Yeah, it might have been 40 by then. When the
bomb pot comes up, is someone got a timer, or is it just like now's the time? Or?
No, so every time a new dealer sits down, we bomb
pot. Oh, okay, that's easy.
And we have a separate bomb pot button. Yeah, we do bomb pots properly in
Sounds Stones. Like.
And it's funny that a lot of people don't know what bomb pots are. I'm like, what are you doing with your life? Why are you bomb potting?
Yeah. So when a new dealer comes in, is the button established right then, or do they draw for a button, or it's just whoever was going to be the next one when the dealer comes in, that's where the button's at?
So we, someone puts the bomb pot, but I've never seen us draw for the bomb pop button. I think it just starts in seat one. And as long as the bomb pop button and the actual button are not at the same person, we'll just progressively move the bomb pop button and hopefully it makes it to seat eight by the end of the night. Not always.
Okay.
But because each dealer's in for like 30 minutes, I believe.
Yeah. Okay.
So I guess in that hand it was $40 in pre-flop. I'm sitting in the cutoff. Bart Hansen's in the small blind. You get dealt your cards. The money gets pulled in, and you play post-flop.
Yeah. So there's no action pre-flop, right?
Yeah, your action's just you've already put your money
You've already put your $40 in. Okay, so for this one, you guys are seven-handed. So my poker math tells me that that's $280.
Nice work, Stevie.
Thank you. Yes,
fist bump.
Yes. Virtual fist.
I feel like I miscalculated that I was, you know, I had some wine, and I believe I bet like 75 on the turn, which is like sort of on the small side for having a boat there.
Okay. So we got 280 in the pot. You said you were in the, I didn't write down your position.
I was in the cutoff.
Okay. Small blind. Okay.
Steve, did you slide in some strategy talk here? You know,
did you see how I did that? I just slid it right in.
Nice work. I don't like talking about hands. No. I'm sorry.
You guys should have like a podcast or something. You guys are good at this.
Thank you. 212 episodes in counting. Here we go. So Bart's in the small blind with the queen of spades, four hearts. He's got queen four offsuit. And the interesting part about this bomb pot thing, I've never played it, and apparently I don't know what I've been doing with my life, but anyone can have any two cards because you can't filter people out pre-flop if you have aces. You just got it. There's your flop and you start playing, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You can get we do them too. Not as frequently, but there's people like it, you know, but if there's a gambling player, we, you know, accommodate them by doing that.
Okay.
And I'm sure Veronica's had these nights where you're playing really well and stacking it. And it's like, you leave down and you're like putting it together. It's like, well, if I didn't lose 3,000 in those two bomb pots.
Yeah.
You can run into it there.
Kind of bomb pots are you playing? Oh my God. Are you playing a 25-50 game or something?
No, I mean, if you do 25 bucks each, there's already over 200 in. So if somebody, someone bets 150 bucks and you got bottom two pair, I mean, you just, your chips are going in there sometimes, you know, 1500. But anyways, Steve, continue with the hand.
Okay, here we go. All right. So Bart's got queen four and you've got 4-4. And the flop comes out. It goes queen three, rainbow. Everyone checks through. Bart was in early position. He said he wanted to check just because he's probably checking his entire range there to lead out anyone, seven players. Anyone can have the other queen, which is very likely going to be a better kicker than a four. So it checks through. And then on the turn, we get...
Not the one outer, I hope. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes. So on the turn, we get the case four.
And no, for Christ.
You got pocket fours. So you got a boat. You got fours over queens. And Bart hit his perfect card. So now he's got queens over fours. Bart checks again. It checks around to you in the cutoff into 280. You bet 75. And Bart calls and then everyone else folds. So on this, I guess my question here is, once we go to the river, we get the ace of spades, which completes a backdoor flush. And
he check raised me.
He did. He checked again. So now you're value betting your boat and he check raises to 625. So now into a pot of, let me get this right. There's 1200.
What was her bet sizing on the river?
Her bet sizing was 150. So the pot was 430 on the river. Veronica bets 150 and then Bart check raises to 625. So now there's 1200 in the pot and you got to call 475, which you got to be good here at like one out of three, I think. But you were able to fold. And I'm like, how did you figure that out? Was there just too many combos that beat you? Like he's got all ace queens. He has aces might play this way. Queen four, I guess.
Or was it just last call at the bar and you need to hustle away from the table?
How did you fold that? Was it a visual read? Like,
I know I've played with Bart before. Bart's one of my good friends and Bart is not known for being, a spewing wild man. Bart's known for playing the best. And I would say because of the bomb pot and the texture of the board, I think on the river, he's huge under bluffing. So I think that the only combos that he could raise there, but I don't think would, I don't know if like how balanced he wants to be there with me. I kind of put out like a little bit of a blocker bet. I think like any queen will call me, just like a you know, a queen jack kind of hand. Flush. And then like a two pair type hand would call me. But then when I think like my bet sizing was not good. I think I should have went a little bit bigger. I think I should have like,
I was going to say on the turn, you know, if someone's got queen X, you charge them the draw to their boat. But you would obviously in this particular instance, you would have ended up just losing more money, but.
I think that like he has three, sets of like pocket threes there, three pairs of pocket threes.
Yeah.
And I think like that's the lowest end of his range that would be raising me on that river. And I barely think that I think with pocket threes, he's probably calling. And then he's got all his combos of ace queens, his three combos of aces. And then like, I don't know, maybe he has queens.
I think he leads pocket threes on the turn a lot more than queen four too. I could be wrong about that. I would almost take combinations. Yeah,
that too. So I thought about it for a while and I was counting up the chips and I almost did call. And then I was like, you know, I think that the majority of like I'm losing to the majority of the combos he has here that he's raising with, and maybe he's raising with pocket threes. But most of the hands he is raising with, I lose to. I think.
Yeah, like, he's just like you said, under bluffing, because in a game, it's, you know, the whole expression, never go broke in a limp pot. It's kind of like never go broke in a.
Yeah.
Because let's just say, I mean, obviously he's not putting you on queen. What was the flop? Queen 4-3? I'm sorry, queen three. Yeah.
The turn was a four, rivers and eight.
Right. I mean, on the slight chance, if he was sitting on fours, he still might not even be raising the river because you have every combination of hands, including queen three in your range. It's not like you can ever remove certain combos. So.
Right. And that's the thing, that his raising range on the river, it's beating all of my shitty blocker bet range.
I
think I'm surprised at the backlash. I don't know if it's backlash. I would say a lot of people are saying it's an automatic call at the very least for a jam, and I'm like, I think it's a very easy fold. I talked to one of my best friends who got like 45th and 44th in the main event this year. He's like crushing life and poker. And he told me he thought it was like a really good fold. And we talked about, you know, like the different combos and how I'm beat there most of the time. So I don't know. I think the people who matter most to me, who I respect the most in poker, have agreed with my fold. But man, a lot of people slid into my DMs berating me.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. That's not fair.
It's fine. Like
They don't understand the bomb pots. Like,
yeah, a lot of
Bart also realizes you have no bluffs in your range. So is he ever going to try to bluff you off what's always like queen X? You know what I mean? Like, so that's why. Yeah, yeah. It's a good fold. I mean,
you articulated really well. I mean, he's got three combos of ace queen, three of aces, three of queen three, two queen fours, and one five deuce of spades for the straight flush. And if
Think
he's not doing that with three, I mean, even if he is doing it with pocket threes, there's you're still massively losing there.
We have.
So
like
Veronica, have you actually, just as we discussed this hand, have you spent a lot of time studying poker, or are you just spending so much time with the smart people? You're just getting all this through osmosis in terms of counting combos.
I'm so lucky with my group of friends. I'm friends with a lot of the high stakes cash game players in San Jose and Sacramento. And a lot of them also do very well in tournaments. So I'm very lucky in that, like, some of it is through osmosis. I also occasionally will, I have a full-time job and I have to do a lot of studying with that. And it takes up a lot of my bandwidth. So when I come home after like 9 hours of grinding at work, I really like I'm not in the mood to watch poker videos. But when I do, like, I'll watch some run at once. I'm very, very interested in Omaha 8. I find Limit Omaha 8 to be, like, what, you know, it's just, like, a beautiful, well-structured game. It's one of my favorites. And so I have watched, like, all of the Omaha 8 stuff on Run at Once, which is, like, four videos. But, yeah, I mean,
Pot Limit or just Limit?
Just Limit.
Okay. Yeah.
There's, I mean, it's hard to find, no one spreads a Pot Limit 8 game, like a PLO 8 game. I have never been able to find it besides the series.
I've got the casino I'm at, the Big O, the five card, which is, you know, the split pot game is really
good. Yeah, five card always... So Stone's applied for a license for Big O, but I still haven't heard anything about it. But once that game goes, oh my gosh, that's going to be awesome.
I haven't played that's... one of those ones. You get five cards instead of four or two, right? And then it's the same five community cards. Is it like Omaha where you still have to play two in your hand?
Yeah.
Not three?
Okay. I think we've been saying it wrong as poker players for a long time, and I think it confuses people. I think we should always say you can only use three cards on the board.
Oh, that's an interesting one.
Because, like, I think people get, like, pretty confused with their hands, and I did too initially when I first started playing, like, a double paired board, like, in Omaha 8, you're still happy with your straight.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it's not, you have to use two of your cards, but.
Huh. You don't want an oil rigger from Saskatchewan misreading his hand there. He'll be angry at the table, probably.
You do want it.
Yeah, they actually do at my casino, the 5-5 PLO and then PLO 8 mix has become.
Oh, wow. So what casino is that?
Oceans 11 in Oceanside, California. So that, yeah, I don't know, but it's interesting. Yeah. Is when I heard they were going to do it, I immediately bought a book and watched a couple training videos as well. And I got very excited about it. But I got in maybe a little late, like I think right away. Yeah. The game, whenever they get the game up there, it'll be gold. And then eventually, of course, pardon me. You know, some players will go broke pretty fast and some people will get better, but I still think, much better than No Limit Hold'em in terms of the number of players who probably just don't get it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, just not good. Yeah. Yeah. Huh. I need to learn Big O. They have it all the time at my casino. I sat down and played 10 minutes of it once before a tournament and I just walked away confused and lost $7. I'm like, I don't know what's going on.
I'm only 6.5 hours away from Oceanside. So I'll see you guys tonight.
Okay, cool. We'll be there.
I literally just like Google mapped, you know, how far it would be for me to get down to Oceanside to play some PLO and PLO 8 mixed game.
It's a neat little casino. It's cool. Mike's there all the time.
There's like a cool little beachside casino in Santa Cruz that my friend Andrew plays at all the time. And it sounds kind of like the same thing.
This one's just not far from, it's a 2-minute drive from the beach. So, yeah, a lot of our regulars are like, I wish they would get the fuck out. But San Diego's so nice. Yeah, they could go to L.A. and have a bigger win rate, but they wouldn't be able to surf and then cruise right over to the casino. You know what I mean? So,
yeah. San Diego's gorgeous. Living the dream out there.
Yeah. You mentioned Vanessa that you had a you mentioned Veronica that you had a hand with Vanessa Selbst.
Yeah, I didn't see her hand, and I tried remembering exact details, and I'm gonna sound like such a fish saying it because I can't remember the whole thing, but I remember she was out of position and I was like in mid position in seat one, and we had like three tables left. And
this was the ladies event, right?
Yeah. I think she was like in seat 7 or 8. We were 9-handed. And so I opened, I don't even remember what the blinds were at that time. I typically was opening like 2.5 to 3.5X depending on my position.
Okay.
And I had ace king. She called and I flopped two pair. And I remember, I think she was like trying to bluff me. I can't even I can't even tell you what the action was. I had the fear of sounding like a fish. But I remember flopping two pair and like 10 came on the turn, which would like complete Broadway.
Yeah, Queen Jack.
If she had, you know, King Jack. And she let out, and I remember like just calling because I wanted, I think she was still doing that with like a single pair or like a gut shot or something.
And yeah, then, combo draws or something.
Yeah, yeah, and then like she ended up checking river, and I bet like half pot because I think I thought I was good. I think I was beating most of her calling range. Like that board connected more with my raising range than it did her calling range. And then she just folded. But I thought like she was trying to like take a stab at it on the turn. And I will say that the ladies event is probably the best event because I hate saying it's the softest event, but like a lot of the women who come in, it's like their yearly thing. They play in a league, you know, that they're just coming for that game. It's not like, you know, they're playing online, you know, 50 hours a week and
they're just some internet wizard that's sitting
down. Yeah, they're just like, they're there to have fun. It's literally the funnest tournament ever. I've never had so much fun. I go, I'm doing it every year until I die.
Nice.
And I wish I could play it like 2-3 times a year. I love it so much.
I hear a lot of women say the same thing. What is it? I mean, I have no. I heard, first of all, the play is quicker because every damn woman's not taking time to fake tank and stare at each other. Is that-
You don't have the egos. That's what it is. That would be nice. That would be nice.
So I think what Vanessa was doing, I think she got away with for 3 days, and the play definitely shifted on day three. It was a lot harder. I know I pretty much got away with everything in the first 2 days. And then day three, it was like, oh, this is a real tournament.
Like, oh, now they're good. we wiped out the scraps. Now we're on some real competition.
Kathy Liebert was on one of my tables on day two for a couple of hours. And like, she is one of my favorite female poker players. She's actually one of my favorite poker players ever. Cool. I like idolized her when I first started playing, and it's just like amazing to sit at a poker table with her. She's hilarious and she plays so well. And I just feel like such a fucking Neanderthal compared to her when it comes to poker. So cool. It's just like a delightful tournament.
That's how Phil Hellmuth is to me. I know exactly what you're talking about. Yep.
I would say Kathy Liebert's better than Phil Hellmuth.
I will take that bet. I will take that bet. 10 heads up matches, Hellmuth versus Liebert. I want action on each one.
I would actually give you more than even money. I would probably like do 1.5 for Kathy.
Wow.
That's a bold statement.
Steve, deep breath, Steve. Steve is getting angry here. Steve has a thing for powerful men, Hellmuth, Genghis Khan, you know what I mean? So he is unable to assess it, clearly.
I'm just visualizing dollar signs, Mike. That's all that's happening right now.
Hellmuth lives close to me, actually. He lives in,
in Palo Alto. Yeah. I've had him on the show a couple of times. And he's just my idol. Any listener will tell you. If you ask who Steve's favorite poker player is, it's not Mike. It's Phil Hellmuth.
What? Taking notes now, Steve's idol is Phil Hellmuth.
Yes, yes. I'm a Scorpio. Like long walks on the beach.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And you enjoy Phil Hellmuth's positivity?
I do. Have you read that one?
No.
Oh.
I will not be reading any Phil Hellmuth books.
I think she's being sarcastic, Steve. He's not really thought of someone as positive towards other people, certainly, but he's written a book on positivity, which you obviously were moved by.
Yes, I was hashtag positivity. Yes. My mind, he's the greatest player that's ever lived. I mean, just
brace. I think it. Definitely. Okay.
We get it, Steve.
Look, I no, will have to agree with you, Steve, because like people talk a lot of shit about Phil Hellmuth, and he has bracelets. Like, you can't argue with results. I mean, his demeanor is not loved by everyone, but I mean, I think he is best at dealing with a lot of like mid-level field type players, where like these guys are playing daily tournaments back home, and then they're coming to the series and they're playing these $1,500 events, and Phil Hellmuth like knows exactly how to play against them.
Right.
And I think pros really are always making like really good decisions that are in a vacuum, and they're not thinking about, you know, the pros or the amateur's mind, maybe. I don't know. I'm trying to give him some credit.
I think, yeah, I think for sure he's got a gift with the exploitive play. I think people are coming back to that too, because so many people know GTO. Yeah. And like you said, a lot of the money, really most of the money in poker, is by taking advantage of these mid-level sort of average people. That's where the money. So like the money, like even if like Phil started playing the super high rollers, he's going to get torn to pieces, I think. But that's not really a good investment of his time anyways.
I would argue and say that like 5% of players know GTO, and I would say most people are playing a little bit more with feel and are not discussing ranges with their group of friends.
I guess I'm talking about when you say Phil gets a lot of hell, I'm thinking of like a lot of the poker pros.
Yeah.
Not just like casual players who, you know, who will probably give him more respect. But no, he certainly knows how to win poker tournaments.
He does. I mean, I always tell people, I'm like, well, I mean, how many bracelets do you have? Like, how are you? Like, the results just speak for themselves.
You
like,
have 15 yet? No? Oh, okay. Let me know when you do.
I mean, if you're sleeping through class and you still get an A, like, how do we argue with that? I don't know.
He does. Some of the things that he says about poker are just dopey. It might be deliberate, where he's leveling everyone and just trying to conceal the level of aptitude.
Yeah, he might be trolling us all. Like, I have a really good friend of mine. He plays 2550 out here. He crushes. I think he made over $1 million last year, just like cash in a few tournaments. And he trolls better than everybody else. He when a guy asks for a setup change, he's like, good job. Yeah, like maybe we'll get a luckier deck. Like, just totally trolls everyone. And it's his job. He just wants to make more money.
Yeah.
That's what I want when I walk into a card room, lose money, and start getting mocked by the millionaire.
Yeah, I mean,
but I guess there's so much ego involved. It does. He knows what he's doing. Obviously, that makes him money.
Most of the players don't know that they're being mocked by him, or he's patronizing them. Like they don't know. Like, he just agrees with them, and like when they complain to him, he's like, "Yeah, there's nothing you could have done." Yeah. Yep. Man, yeah. It was just a bad run of cards.
Yeah, that was just a cooler, dude. Nothing you could have done.
Like, literally, this guy studies for like 2-3 hours a day and knows, he like works like a robot. He knows every out, every like pot odd, everything. And he just tells people, yeah, nothing you could do.
No getting away from that one, sir.
Oh, man. Bart Hansen did that to me once, and I wanted to cry. We were playing 5-10 at Live of the Bike. And he was on my left, and I was just having such a fucking horrible night. And I remember flopping, and I flopped open-ended, and I turned a flush draw, and river came a brick. I lost like a good part of my stack. And I remember Bart Hansen saying, nothing you could have done. And I like looked at him. I'm like, God damn it, Bart, are you seriously? Like, oh, and then I've never stopped texting him about that. I'm like, are you serious? Did you seriously say that to me?
So great.
It sounds like you're playing in some pretty big games. Do you have a backer who takes a piece of your action in these things? Or
no, I do not have a backer. I've never had a backer.
So where do we go? I'm kind of a fanboy here. Let's pretend I'm your PR agent. I'm just going to assume you want to grow a bit into a star here. Is that true at all? No.
No, that's not.
No? Because I'm watching the coverage, and I'm thinking, you don't think to yourself, you know what? I can do commentary as good as Jamie Kerstetter, and I'm more beautiful than Kara Scott. I could be the on-screen interviewer person. This doesn't this isn't a thought of yours at all?
No, I like, oh my God, Jamie Kerstetter is a brilliant, amazing, hilarious woman that I am just like knee high to a grasshopper to. I am quite happy at my job. I have a really good paying career. I don't really care about bringing fame to what I'm doing. It's like so weird.
Just for fun.
I just enjoy poker. I lightly tweet. I do like I play. You know, I have my own game, but I'm like not interested in more. I don't think like my hourly would go up doing any of those other things. And my hourly is too high to leave what I'm doing to go attempt to try to, you know, become more of a commentator on ESPN or something. I just, plus I'm in my 40s. So I think.
You are, really?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
So those, I think those, it's not like I'm going to, you know, in 10 years be able to, you know, be this, I don't know. It's just for women on TV, I think. Your lifespan is a lot shorter than men, so
it sounds like you really enjoy what you're doing. And
so I have been fired as your PR person because you don't need one, apparently. I was getting so excited of us working together, and you know, me coming up with all sorts of bullshit plans,
and you getting like 10% of like all the $500 I make.
I didn't even think of that. I was just, yeah, going to live vicariously through your rise.
I'll just tell you, like, commentary does not pay that well. My hourly in commentary goes way down compared to like my hourly at work. So it's like you just do it for love.
Yeah.
The Thirst Lounge reached out to me and asked me to audition, and I'm like, no, like I'm sorry, I have a regular job. I can't do that. Like I wouldn't have fun. I'd be such a bitch on that island. I'd be like, get me the fuck off this island.
A lot of people would find that endearing.
Yeah. I just like, it's not for me. I'm too grumpy right now. I'm not grumpy. I'm just like, it's not my thing. I just like want to be by myself and then like occasionally go to a movie with a friend. Like I'm just not really that social, even though I come across like it on social media.
So what's on the horizon for until the next WSOP? What you got any circuits planned, anything like that?
I was thinking about going to Run It Up Reno in October.
Okay.
Everybody and their dog goes to Run It Up Reno, and it's like considered the mini World Series of Poker without all of the douchebaggery associated with it. Like,
yeah.
There's no like promotional, no one selling you cell phones or cell phone chargers in the hallway.
Blue Shark Optics.
Yeah. So it's just like, I'll probably go down.
Probably a few less people from Dusseldorf staring at you at the table.
I'm hoping like that is like prime time of me implementing the new software. I've got like this month span where I've got different things that I'm implementing over different periods of time because of like regulations. And so I will try to get down there. I typically like just will play any WPT event that comes through Northern California. Although I haven't even been doing that this year because my project is like a year long project and it's like just takes up my entire life. And all I want to do is go play the ladies event again. That's all I dream about. I actually am thinking, I was so exhausted after day three. Like, I don't know if you guys saw my tweet. I don't know how poker pros do it. Like,
yeah.
In
the tournament for 3 days and I needed like a week in the ICU after. I was so physically and mentally exhausted. And I think I'm just going to take like an entire week, go play the ladies, go chill by the pool. Like this time it was like the entire time I was there I was playing and then I left the next day.
Yeah.
So. That's interesting. For me, Vegas is the least arduous time of the year. Well, I mean, it's the most emotional and tough, so it's not, but just in terms of hours. I don't know if you're used to any long cash game, but I just can't leave a game if it's good. This is how I
pay my bills.
So yeah, I've played 18 hours plus many, many times. So the tournaments are not quite as brutal.
So I would say, and you're talking about tournaments, 18 hours of tournaments?
No, I think the most tournaments you can do in a day is probably 12 hours, unless you're, you know, final table. I'm talking about, I play a lot of cash, like
yeah. So
50 hours a week. So, and sometimes in at least one of those days, it's yesterday I played for 15 hours.
So tell me now, like I'm wondering if you would agree with me. I think that tournaments and cash are very different mentally. Like in a cash game, your blinds aren't going up. That's not a stressor to you, and you can get up as you please. You can you can order food and chill. I mean, you can still
overall.
But like in the tournament, you're structured. Like you do not want to miss a hand, and so you're structured in a way where you're like trying to go to the bathroom every 2 hours and. Then like you're constantly on, like in a cash game, there are times where I'll just like get up and just like walk around, grab some water and then sit back down. It doesn't mean that much to miss some hands, but in the tournament, like I remember the end of day two and I have like one friend who bought 10% of me in the ladies event. And I had like the guy who I was dating at the time, he was there. And like, I got up during the last three hands. I had like second in chips at the time, I believe. I had to go to the bathroom so bad, I thought I was gonna die. And like, I got berated. They're like, "What are you doing? You don't get up. You know, like you just don't get up." And I was just like, "Look, I'm gonna die if I don't go to the bathroom." And I think that was like a priority to me at that time, at that point. And I was just like, I already have like a really good chip lead. I'm good. I'm fine. I was mentally exhausted. But yeah, I think like it's exhausting in a tournament. I've played long cash games. I try not to play like more than 8 hours just because like I don't want to sit there and like die in the seat or something. But I think that it's a different exhaustion. But I don't mean to belittle your experience as a cash game player playing for 18 hours, but I don't know if you would agree with me on the tournament.
No, I agree with you 100%. I understand. Yeah. Especially like 3 or 4 days in a row in a tournament, a lot of money. Yeah. The stress and the, you know, when I bag for a tournament, I can't even sleep for 2 hours.
Your
adrenaline is like still pumping. Whereas, you know, a cash game, obviously
on it the entire time, you're always calculating how big is my stack? How big is the stack to my left? Because they're constantly,
and obviously
it's not like everyone just has 200 big blinds, you know, I agree. It's more,
and running obviously, running really bad in anything is horrible, but the bad beats in tournaments can be so much more painful than they are in the cash games.
Yeah. It's just emotional. I'm an emotional wreck in tournaments. And I had one dealer. I was so in love with her. Everything was blinds. It's a 3-blind bet. I was like, wow, I love that. I feel like people who don't watch tournaments, especially the ones who messaged me and they're like, "Why don't you cash out right now?"
Yeah.
You know, and they think like, "Oh my God, you had 600,000 in chips. How did you lose?" And I'm like, "Well, I had like 13 big blinds." Like, it wasn't really that much relative to the blinds, and people don't understand that. But I think
I used to twitch quite a bit, and my brother would watch sometimes. And you know, if I go late in a tournament where there's like 20K plus for first, and he would just be sending me texts, "Just fold. If you fold just turn off the computer. You'll move up and make 2,000. And I'm like trying to explain to him, and of course, sometimes he's right. That would have been better if I did that rather than just bluffing it off. But yeah, I try to explain to him, you have to try to win these tournaments, and you know, but
that's hilarious. Yeah, I can't even tell you how many people messaged me telling me to cash out 600,000, and like, what do you mean you had 600,000 and now you have $7,300? I'm like, it doesn't work.
You're not listening to what I'm saying.
Yeah, at the ladies event, a $500,000 buy-in.
You said the guy you were dating at the time, did was he jealous of your poker prowess? Is he a poker player and just couldn't deal with it psychologically?
We're friends. We're still friends. He's a high stakes cash game player out here and wonderful guy. You know, sat at my rail for hours and hours each day.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah. He was never jealous. He was like, he just thought it was great. So I don't think I could date a guy who's has jealousy in his body.
Right.
It's not an attractive quality either way.
The thing was, I was thinking of this deep tournament and how you are already excited for next year. You're kind of, this isn't really me sliding in a brag, but I had a couple deep runs like 3 years ago.
And okay, I'm listening.
I'm like, that's cost me like $100,000 at least.
Just chasing it again?
That's just going back to Vegas and firing and just wanting to, you know, build that stack for day three or four of a tournament. There's no feeling like it, right?
Which events?
I came in 18th in the Colossus a few years ago.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Yeah, my friend Andrew got like fourth or fifth in the Colossus this year.
That's a good one. I think there's one year I went deep in the Millionaire Maker. It was like a 30K cash. I think you got
43rd.
That sounds about right.
Yeah. Nice.
And I won a Venetian tournament. I'm not trying to, you know, but overall at this point, if I'm treating this like a business, which I should be, then I should be investing certainly less money in poker tournaments, I think. But you have a different situation. You can be a dreamer because you have a good job.
Yeah, I like dreaming. Although, like, depending on your score, a lot of poker players will fire off like a good portion of their winnings that year to try to, I think, like, I can't remember what it is. Like, you try to double it up or not have to pay the taxes on it. Or like reduce the amount of taxes you're going to pay.
I know California's, but I don't even really look in the details. I should, but I think California, a lot of people say, is like the worst for a poker player.
Yeah.
You could prove to them that you lost 100,000 in tournaments, in LA tournaments, but you will pay 30% or whatever it is on your 110K cash. And it's kind of ridiculous.
Really?
Well, yes. You basically, I think, I don't claim like my, I've never claimed my tournament losses because I don't think there were enough.
Right.
You'd have to like lose all of your money in order to like benefit from the tax structure in California. I think you'd be almost in the negative, right?
Well, I don't know. You can't, as a professional gambler, you cannot claim that you lost money for the year, which is kind of weird, you know? So,
oh wow, that's really bad. Well, there's an accountant I know who apparently deals with all of the professional poker players and knows how to file optimally. So
okay, maybe if you don't mind, I'll DM you on Twitter here, and you can give me contact. That name.
He actually all my high stakes cash game friends use him. So
okay. There you go, Mike.
Yeah, I've also got all the Bitcoin shit to add to my taxes. I still haven't done my taxes for last year, which God only knows. I lost like 40K, but somehow I just know it's going to be.
I don't think you're. Oh, you cashed it out?
Yeah, unfortunately, I had to. Yeah, I was buying. Dude.
When did you cash out? When at what price?
Well, kind of along the way. I mean, I'm just quit my. If you want to hear my Bitcoin tragedy story. I bought it at a pretty good time when it was six, and then, you know, it hit 20 and I actually sold at its height.
Oh, okay.
I was up like a fair amount and still had a lot of money in there, but it started going down and I just kept, you know, I'm a goddamn gambler, just kept buying and buying and buying. And with not just like extra investment money, but with like my life roll. So that went to shit. And then I sold my last six of them for like, 6K, I forget when, and they immediately went down to 3,500, and I was feeling smart, but then, you know, now it's firing in the other direction.
Yeah,
now it's up to 10, 11K.
When they were 3,200.
You said you sold yours?
No, I bought okay. A bunch in December. And then nice. I've been buying Ethereum for a few years, But the first time I bought Ethereum, it was like $750.
Okay.
But then when I bought Ethereum in December, I bought it, I think it was like at $120. And now, I mean, it just tanked a little bit. It was at like $350 last week or 2 weeks ago. And now it's at like $215, I think. I haven't checked my wallet today, but I'm hoping Bitcoin. I was a part of a Bitcoin group in Sacramento. And
really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, we would meet twice a month, I believe. I haven't been able to find anything in Silicon Valley, ironically. But yeah, they were projecting back then. I think they got their timing wrong, but I think their projections might be correct because anyone I know who studies it or knows anything about it says that it's probably going to go up to 100K. They were saying 65K, around 65K by the end of last year. But I think their timing is off. I think it's going to go up.
I'm going to be on 24-hour suicide watch when it hits 100K.
I've got to
manage my money right.
You can't be results oriented. Come on, you got to make the best decision at the time, and then you got regardless of the outcome.
Yeah. No, I've made bad decisions along the way. I don't think.
So you think 100K eventually for Bitcoin? What are you thinking for Ethereum?
I don't know about Ethereum. I don't know. Ethereum's more of my gamble.
Yeah.
I bought like some
Stellar Lumens. Yeah. I had that.
Stellar Lumens. Yeah. I haven't even looked to see how they're doing, but I know like last time I checked, I lost money on that, but I'm all for some gambling. I'll buy some like penny stocks. It's cool. Yeah.
You said you have a rich fantasy life. You like dreaming. What happens to you in 2 years here and all of a sudden you're worth $50 million? What would you do with that?
I think that I could realistically like live off of a lot less. Like I would probably put some away for retirement and I would buy a house out here. I know this sounds crazy, but I don't think I'd quit my job because my job, I took it not for the pay, although the pay is nice. I would say the job I took because it's something that I like to do. And I feel like my brain works the way my job the expectations my job has is exactly how my brain wants to do things. And I really just enjoy it. And I enjoy the work that the county does and stuff. So I also like the mental stimulation, like poker. I think if I just quit everything and just played poker, I think like I would hate poker. And I went through a period of time hating poker. I probably would donate a good amount of that to, I don't know if you guys read any Peter Singer, but there's like a lot of altruism effective altruism groups that like donate really well to good causes that, have the most benefit. I probably would donate a good amount of it to like malaria, reducing malaria in Africa, or you know, whatever givewell.org, whatever they would recommend, like their top three charities. I probably would give like a lot of it to that. And I would probably just like pay off a house and just chill.
You probably put $15 million on the Super Bowl, right? I mean, if you don't need all the money.
No, I would not do that. But I
would describe yourself as a gambling or as a degen on Twitter, are you kind of being, I mean, do you like bet on sports? Do you have?
No, I would say like the degen is that like the games I play in tend to get crazy and like I will pick spots to gamble in, but
right,
like, I would never, sports betting's great. I just think like, I think you need to be running a good amount of analytics and know what the fuck you're doing. And I think 99% of people don't, and most of them just play by feel, and I think it's just a bad spot. I'd like to just put myself in spots where I have like the best chance to win something. I would give a lot of strippers money though. I would be at the Rhino a lot if I won $50 million.
Nice.
See, now that's we like that. That's where your heart's at.
Yeah, I mean, someone's got to pay for their law school.
And someone does.
I was trying to picture myself with millions and millions of dollars and trying to come up with some bullshit charity that I'd be giving to Steve just to impress my compassionate side, but no, yeah. If I won the Powerball, I would be paying off the mortgages of a lot of people. I think that would be my act of generosity.
You say that and that's wonderful. I think like I would probably pay off my friends' mortgages too, but like really what would happen is you'd probably have to hide and like run away from anyone who's ever known you, who's going to hit you up for money. Like I know my friend Andrew, who made the final table, and his score was like, I think under 200,000 this year.
Take the taxes out and everything. He's not like he's life-changing money.
Yeah, really. And like he said, so many people were hitting him up for money. I'm like, what? Are you serious for that? Like, I can't even imagine if you win the main event, what, like people will come out of the woodwork. You have to change your address. You have to like, you got to change your phone number. I'm sure everyone would hit you up. It's probably a miserable life.
Yeah, that's probably, there was actually, this was years ago.
Jerry Yang?
I found this fascinating. Mm-hmm. Maybe I shared it. But there is a New York Magazine article and basically looking at luck. And they took the people with the best luck ever, which is winning like Powerball, going from working to 100 million. And they took the worst luck ever, which is people becoming crippled, disabled through some horrible accident. And basically, it was pretty similar reactions amongst the two. I had a lot to do with the person. If you're just if you're kind of a negative person, then winning the lottery could cause you a lot of problems. Like you said, alienating you from friends and family and make a lot of bad decisions. So I thought it was pretty interesting, obviously.
So I kind of, I had like a really life-changing event happen to me almost 3 years ago. I lost a son to cancer. And I have completely, like you see my Twitter, I put 2.0 out there recently. Mm-hmm. Like, I wouldn't say I completely have changed. Because I still struggle with like a ton of grief and anger and like, I'm not a perfect human being. But one thing that I have come out of that with is this incredible gratitude for just like simple parts of life and just being here. And I think like there are studies that show like your happiness peaks at like 100,000 a year, and anything over that's just kind of gravy, doesn't add to your happiness. And like, I think I don't need much to fulfill myself. Like my fulfillment comes with like my group of friends. I have enough to get by and more. And, you know, like, I think like a lot of people have it wrong. Like the money isn't going to bring them happiness. And like the people, I think, focus on the wrong things, to fulfill themselves, when really like the fulfillment comes with friends and time spent and, making memories and stuff like that. I know it sounds really corny, but like, I work at a place where I think pays really well, and I have like great coworkers, but I still see people who are just miserable at their job. And I'm just like, you're missing so much gratitude. And also, if it's making you this miserable, go somewhere else.
Yeah. Then why are you here?
Yeah. Like I would honestly, if I used to work as a nurse, and, I was not happy at that job. I really did not like nursing. And like, even if you offered me double what I'm making now, I wouldn't do it, because it's not the money that I care about. It's like the fulfillment at work. And I feel the same way about relationships. Like I wouldn't date a rich guy just because he's rich. Like I would not have fulfillment just, you know, having a guy pick me up in a nice car. Like I have my own, by the way, but like, I just want different things. I think like monetary drives are the worst things ever for people's happiness.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Spend time doing things that you enjoy.
Steve, this is a good time to end here. We have a nice positive ending from a wise woman. Normally it's just me babbling, you know?
We just throw these positive points, sprinkle them around, dusting. I love it.
I feel like I lectured a little bit in that last part.
No, you
deposited a little golden nugget in the seed, in the mind of everyone listening. I like it.
Although for all the broke asses out there, money is sometimes people are just put in that situation where they have to obsess over it, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, I grew up really poor. I'm an immigrant. Like my parents came from Poland and we escaped communism. Like we came with $50 to Canada. And I grew up so poor with parents who were obsessed over money. And I'm so lucky to have been able to been in a, to get myself into a position in life where I'm making good money and still doing something I love and not having to work, you know, grind three jobs. And like, I totally get that. Like, you do have to pay your rent. You do have to pay your mortgage. Like, so you just got to get yourself to a place where like you're comfortable and then enjoy your life. I don't know if that's possible for everyone.
I had a millionaire tell me once, and I've never forgotten it, and that's how I live my life, is you always live just a little bit below your means. Never at your means or above, just a little bit below, and you'll never have to worry about paying the bills. And
yeah, I'm such a nihilist, though. I'm just like, well, fuck, I probably won't live tomorrow. Like, I might not make it till tomorrow, so, you know, I'm going to order, like, another bottle of wine that is going to cost me $200, but I don't care.
If you guys want to get Veronica on Twitter, you can find her at Angry Pollock.
Angry underscore Pollock.
Underscore. Sorry, I forgot the underscore. We'll put a link in the show notes. Is there anything else you wanted to give a shout out to, Veronica?
No, that's it.
Cool. Disappointed won't get to see you on Stones. Of course, you can still go on YouTube.
If
people have never seen Veronica.
Yeah,
I wouldn't recommend.
Do commentary. She's a lot of fun.
A little bit of a shit show. And then when I did commentary, it was like a little wild. I did do commentary with a few cool pros. That might be on there if anyone's interested.
Okay, cool. Right on. Well, thank you for coming on the show, Veronica. And thank you, Mikey. And thank you for tuning in. Here is your weekly motivational speech.
We all have two people. We have the easy voice, which is that very comfortable voice holding you saying, it's going to be okay. Doesn't care how good you are, just loves you. Just loves you no matter how messed up you are in life. That's that voice that we all love. This other voice that we walk very far away from is a voice saying, hey man, you're not working your butt off hard enough. You're not trying hard enough. Turn up this voice over here. The voice saying things to you that aren't nice. I'm saying listen to the truth. The truth is in this other part of your brain saying, look man, you're wasting a bunch of percentage here. We have 80 more percent that we're not tapping into because in this other 80% is suffering, pain, failure, self-doubt, darkness, and then a whole bunch of light. But to get to this light, you gotta go through all of this So everybody goes, how do you do that? You know exactly how to do that. It's not a magic trick. It's all back down to a very primitive mindset of we just have to do. When that alarm clock goes off at 4 or 5 in the morning, your mind says no. You just say, this is what we do. It's what we do now. And that's your new norm. You will not find toughness in a comfortable environment. The only way you find it is to drown yourself in a position where you're just out of sorts, where you can't swim and you're drowning. You're drowning in life. When you say, you know what, man? Fuck that. I'm gonna figure out how to fucking backstroke or something. When you quit, your mind says, we're done. So it doesn't expand. There's no expansion when you quit. When you say, fuck you, this sucks, I'm drowning, I'm miserable, I'm suffering, I'm broken, but I'm not going anywhere. What happens to your mind, it says, fuck, he's not leaving. So we gotta expand, we gotta grow, we gotta figure this fucking thing out. So then these compartments in your brain, they have to work. And then you start to engage parts of your mind that you've never engaged before when you're in suffer mode and you say, I'm not gonna quit. And then once you do this over and over and over again, it becomes like breathing. I don't wanna live this lifestyle, but to get to the other side of this, I have to.